Good morning. This is Brian Trumbor with your week in review for May 2nd. I want to say up front that I'll have all kinds of details on the Chrysler bankruptcy in my week in review column, and I'm not going to touch on it here. So for starters, let's talk about H1N1. Little did I know when I was in Reykjavik, Iceland last Saturday morning, and I commented in my week in review column that perhaps I should stay there until swine flu blew over, that I ended up being not too far from the truth. Alas, we can be thankful that it would appear we are dealing with nothing more than another flu strain, a not too lethal one at that, the one that still has disturbing characteristics and may yet return in the fall or winter in a more virulent fashion. Karen Kaplan of the Los Angeles Times wrote, "Sometime in the last few years, as the world's attention was focused on the bird flu that killed more than 250 people in Asia, another bird flu strain infected pigs. It mixed with two kinds of flu that are endemic in swine and a fourth that originally came from people. The resulting concoction spread among pigs, then recently, no one yet knows where or when, started infecting humans." Dr. Scott Lane, an epidemiologist at the UCLA School of Public Health, said scientists have yet to identify which features help H1N1 spread or kill. "The microscope doesn't tell you anything," he said. "What are the genetic correlates of virulence? Unknown. Transmissibility? Unknown." Because it's summertime, many experts do believe the virus could burn itself out in the next 4 to 6 weeks, but again, reappear as happened in 1918. Speaking of which, John M. Barry wrote the definitive book on the topic of 1918, The Great Influenza. Commenting in an op-ed for the New York Times, Barry notes, "What's important to keep in mind in assessing the threat of the current outbreak is that all four of the well-known pandemics seem to have come in waves. The 1918 virus surfaced by March and set in motion a spring and summer wave that hit some communities and skipped others. This first wave was extremely mild, more so than ordinary influenza. Of the 10,313 sailors in the British Grand Fleet who became ill, for example, only four died. But autumn brought a second, more lethal wave, which was followed by a less severe third wave in early 1919. The first wave in 1918 was relatively mild, many experts speculate, because the virus had not fully adapted to humans. And as it did adapt, it also became more lethal. However, there's very good evidence that people who were exposed during the first wave developed immunity, much as people get protection from a modern vaccine." John Barry continues, "A similar kind of immune-building process is the most likely explanation for why, in 1918, only 2% of those who contracted the flu died. Having been exposed to other influenza viruses, most people had built up some protection. People in isolated regions, including American Indian reservations and Alaskan Inuit villages, had much higher case mortality, presumably because they had less exposure to influenza viruses. The 1889 pandemic also had a well-defined first wave that was milder than succeeding waves. The 1957 and 1968 pandemics had waves too, though they were less well-defined. In all four instances, the gap between the time the virus was first recognized and a second, more dangerous wave swelled was about 6 months. It will take a minimum 4 months to produce vaccine in any volume, possibly longer, and much longer than that to produce enough vaccine to protect most Americans. The race has begun." That was author John Barry. I was not one of those joking about H1N1 this week, except I felt badly for our pig friends and ate a package of bacon. I happen to be addicted to the pre-cooked Oscar Mayer variety, which doesn't make me a bad person. I kept telling friends who poo-pooed the virus to take it seriously, and I was wondering on Tuesday, for example, what Kentucky's governor might do if, say, the state had a cluster such as that which developed in New York City. Did you then proceed with the Kentucky Derby, where 150,000 would congregate? You saw the precautions taken by the likes of Fort Worth, Texas, and their school district, which shut down schools until May 11th. Was that being overly cautious? I'm not going to question such moves. My point is, we can take away quite a few lessons from the past week. We should all take heart that at least in the United States we have the Centers for Disease Control and the experts there. I have full confidence they are doing the best they can. I thought President Obama handled the situation totally appropriately. though I also watched the first 30 minutes of Today each morning as part of my routine, and I was incredulous when I saw Vice President Biden do his shtick with Matt Lauer. I can't believe he was saying this, I mused that morning. I believe many in the financial community just don't realize how close we came to a true economic disaster. In all seriousness, I myself almost pulled the trigger on my equity holdings first thing Thursday morning because I understand the implications of a full-blown pandemic. All bets would be off at that time. But I analyzed the news as best I could and stayed put. Also, believe me, I will not just listen to the message of the markets in making a decision of this kind. I'll trust my own pretty good instincts over those of a bunch of traders. Assuming H1N1 is now relatively under control and begins to dissipate over the coming weeks, I'm not going to let down my guard, however, this coming fall. The head of the World Health Organization on Wednesday issued a dire warning that the episode was a, quote, time for global solidarity. This was viewed in some quarters as an overstatement. Far from it. It was a responsible one to make because this is a huge wake-up call, though by the actions of many of our experts and policymakers, I am fairly confident that the next time a more serious wave hits, we'll be ready to take the right steps. I do pity, however, other nations of the world. It will be each man for himself, each nation for itself, rich versus poor, and this is one instance where the meek will not inherit the earth. Turning to the global economy, Wall Street's awaiting the results of the now-delayed bank stress test, due out May 7, at last word, rather than this coming Monday, though results were already leaking out as expected. This was a week where a number of economists, for the first time during the crisis, were in agreement that we've hit bottom and there are signs of a turn. Not that it's happy days, far from it, and not that we'll enter a period of sustained growth anytime soon. We don't have nearly enough evidence to support that dream. But it's clearly been two baby steps forward for each normal one backwards the past month in particular. In some cases, such as in China, it's two normal steps forward and one baby step backwards. China is now in a flat-out growth mode, according to various manufacturing indices, as opposed to the contraction we had been witnessing there. I'm referring to a contraction from 8% growth to 6% growth, and now growth back to 8%, it would seem. New loan origination here is soaring. Witness the example last week of my own holding there, obtaining a sizable line of credit. This will eventually create a new bubble, but I'll cross that bridge later. In Japan, the Bank of Japan says GDP will contract 3.1% over the coming 12 months. Not good. But at the same time, many now believe the economy will expand 1.2% in the second quarter. Factory output in March was off 34% year over year there, but over February was up. Yes, the Japanese government adds deflation will be the order of the day here for possibly the next 2 years, but Japan is bottoming. In Taiwan, PC makers say the industry is bottomed there and the market slowly improving. On the other hand, global semiconductor sales slumped 30% in March from a year earlier, but here again, we're up over February. For its part, global software king SAP was far less optimistic in releasing its latest earnings report. In Europe, the retail sales outlook is improving and consumer confidence rising in some key nations such as France and Italy. Previously, we had seen similar sentiment readings in Germany. In Britain, a key manufacturing index hit an 8-month high. Still in recession mode, mind you, but a distinct improvement. On the other hand, as you would expect, unemployment, a lagging indicator, continues to rise across Europe. In the U.S., two leading consumer confidence figures for April surged to levels far better than expected. Still poor overall, but a plus nonetheless. Various manufacturing indices here also exhibited better than expected readings for the month, and in the case of the Chicago Purchasing Managers Index and the National ISM Barometer, both got back over the 40 level. 50 is the dividing line between actual growth and recession, so no one is as yet celebrating Chicago PMI Day, but another positive. Earnings continue to come in mostly better than expected. But here it needs to be pointed out the bar had been lowered so far it was almost like starting the Olympic high jump competition at 3 feet 8 inches. Earnings estimates will now be ratcheted higher and thus tougher to beat in succeeding quarters. This week the Federal Reserve held its open market committee meeting on rates. No action there. And then the accompanying statement said the pace of decline in the economy, quote, appears to be somewhat slower, but the economy could, quote, remain weak for some time. Separately, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker added he felt the economy has leveled off, but we were still, quote, in for a long slog. Not great, but an improvement from previous sentiment. Recall, long ago I first touched on the three-legged stool, housing, the consumer, and business spending. The burst of the housing bubble begat the collapse of the wealth effect, which begat lower consumer spending, which begat decreased business investment. Now, as I've been writing the past month in particular, there are distinct signs housing has bottomed. Again, not that we are near to being off to the races, far from it. I have been totally consistent in my housing comments for years now. Once we hit bottom, we sit there for an extended period in terms of housing values. But there is increasing evidence that my belief of last fall that we would bottom the April-May time period could be spot on. This week, the S&P Case-Shiller Index for February, its latest recording period, did nothing to dispel my theory as the year-over-year decline for 20 major markets came in at down 18.8%. Awful, but like in so many other economic readings of the past 2 months, a slowing in the rate of decline. Some markets, such as Phoenix, are now more than 50% off their 2006 peak. How much lower can they go? We also learned that the median home price for existing home sales in California in March was actually up over February. Now, there are a few reasons for treating this as a simple blip, but a blip, sports fans, is better than a bleep. I just made that up. Bottom line, there is indeed cause for optimism. A firmer tone in housing would translate into stronger consumer spending. That would then, over time, translate into higher levels of business investment. That would then lead to hiring, not further layoffs. Speaking of layoffs, I believe the employment picture will not get quite as bleak as most forecasts. For starters, very few companies have accompanied their first quarter earnings statements with the levels of layoffs that they were announcing in the second, third, and fourth quarters last year. Barring a true global pandemic, not just a hike to level 6. I'm now saying we do not hit 10% for a formal unemployment rate in the United States. Just a note on the banks, seeing as it appears there will be far more to say upon release of the results next time. One thing that struck me is the stress tests are designed to look at the worst possible economic scenarios, as in a much deeper recession than we are currently experiencing, and resultant capital shortfalls. 6 of the 19 being examined, we're told, or rather it was leaked, are in need of additional funding, Citigroup and Bank of America being the two biggest targets. No one doubts there is a ton of bad paper, mortgages, commercial loans, etc., on the books of virtually all big banks, but the time to do stress tests was 2 to 3 years ago, and 4 to 5 years ago when it comes to derivatives. Someday I'll go back and point out that in 2002, before Warren Buffett's warning on derivatives being weapons of mass destruction, I was saying no one was doing stress tests on their positions. Or if they were, it was one of those long-term capital deals where the brainiacs plugged in the wrong logarithms. So what do these current bank stress tests really mean, especially if the global economy is bottoming? I just throw it out there. I do not doubt that some banks have serious capital issues. But as the Treasury itself is admitting at week's end, they are concerned some good banks are going to get unfairly tainted during this process. Or as former Fed Vice Chairman Alan Blinder said in the Washington Post op-ed, even if the Treasury and the Fed somehow thread the needle, the bank-by-bank specifics are likely to roil markets. And did I mention that getting Congress to vote more money for bank bailouts won't be easy? That was Alan Blinder. Well, turning to the stock market this week, the amazing rally off the March 9 lows resumed, but for NASDAQ, it never ended. NASDAQ is now up an amazing 8 weeks in a row, the longest such streak since 1999, and up 33% during the run. The S&P 500 and Dow Jones were up 1.3% and 1.7% respectively this week after stumbling slightly the previous one. The S&P's rally is 30% off the lows. Yes, I'm like everyone else, kind of hoping for a pause. But as one who said the lows are in, and as the fundamentals now begin to improve, I'm staying put with my view that stocks will finish the year up substantially. The S&P is at 877 now, however, and there are times you can't ignore technicals, and the 890 level seems to be one that is offering stiff resistance. I'll be back with you next Saturday Have a great week, and catch more on my Week in Review column at stocksandnews.com. Thank you.